Welcome. I'm Nikki Clark.
And I'm Tracy Begley.
And this is Intercross, the podcast.
This month marks the 68th anniversary of the 1949 Geneva Conventions. So I am here with Andrea Harrison, our deputy legal advisor, to discuss the pertinence of the Geneva Conventions and some historical aspects of the conventions. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you. Great to be here.
The first Geneva Convention was signed in 1864, just 1 year after the ICRC was founded. It was for the amelioration of the condition of the wounded in armies in the field, and there were 57 states party. There were a number of other Geneva Conventions after that one as well. We had one in 1906 and one after World War I in 1929. And then probably the best known, the four conventions that came in 1949 after World War II. So how, Andrea, do you think have the content of the Geneva Conventions changed over time? And what do you think are some of the more significant advances through the years that we've seen in the conventions?
Great question. So as you mentioned, in 1864, the convention really was primarily concerned with wounded and sick combatants. So really looking at the soldiers, also dead bodies to some extent, but it was really about sort of providing medical care to wounded combatants. And this was based on Henri Dunant's experience at the Battle of Solferino, witnessing so many fallen soldiers who were not cared for after the fact. So that was really the impetus of that first convention. And the 1906 one added a few aspects to this, but really, again, was focusing on the wounded and sick. Whereas by the time we get to the 1929 convention, we were looking at treatment of prisoners of war. So that's where they started to, based on the ICRC's experience and other humanitarian aid organizations, their experience in warfare, they started looking also at the issues of treatment and detention. But again, only of combatants, of soldiers. And so it wasn't until 1949 that we see the first convention that was really pertinent to civilians. And that really came out of the experiences of the First and Second World Wars. If we look at the Battle of Solferino, which Henri Dunant witnessed, there was one civilian casualty. Whereas when we get to World War I, we have about 7 million civilian casualties. And by World War II, we were upwards of 50 million. So partly the change in law reflects the change in how wars were fought. They were fought closer to population centers. And this was really something that the states parties, the drafters and the ICRC were trying to reflect in the 1949 conventions, was a shift to civilian population centers. And one other major transformation that you see in the 1949 conventions has to do with the fact that they finally included a provision on non-international armed conflict through Common Article 3. It was very small, and states couldn't really agree on what they wanted in the law at the time, because they didn't want to necessarily have the law interfering with their internal affairs. But that was a very important development, because it gave us some law pertinent to internal conflicts, or civil wars, as they were called at the time.
And quite significantly, there are actually 196 states that are party to the four Geneva Conventions. And as you mentioned, there are some articles that are common to the four conventions, but of course many of them are different because they pertain to different aspects of armed conflict. But all of these states that are party, they're all party to all four of the conventions. But we had in 1864 only 57 state parties, and then in 1906, 52, and after that, 53 in 1929, and now we see this huge uptick. Do you think that's primarily coming out of the world's experience with World War II, or do you think there are other contributions to that as well?
I'm sure there's historians who could answer this question much better than I can, but my sense is that a number of developments contributed to this. Yes, the experience of World War II in particular, and really what, when we say World War, it really did affect sort of every corner of the planet. So I think that gave more of a buy-in to states who maybe in past past conflicts had just, in so many of the wars we look at and study are often related to European wars, not because that's the only place where war was taking place. It's just, it's what we study, it's what we know in Western civilization anyways. And I think that it wasn't until the 1949 conventions you started to see a buy-in from other you know, Eastern powers, the Latin American powers, and it was because there was really everyone had a stake in the Second World War. So certainly that, I think one of the other big shifts as you start to see what we'll call the Global South starting to sort of play a bigger role in the United Nations, in treaty making processes like this, as colonial era was beginning to shift, and you did have states that were formerly sort of represented by these European powers now really asserting themselves in the global political arena. So I think that there's probably a number of other explanations as well, but I think the important thing to emphasize is that the Geneva Conventions are a universally ratified and sort of a universal set of values. It's not supposed to reflect Western or Christian values. It's really supposed to come out of the customs we see in lawfare in many different countries and regions of the world.
And of course, the sheer number of states that are party just shows the significance and the agreement on some of the basic protections that states do think should exist during armed conflict. But since the first convention in 1864, it's been about every 20 to 40 years we've had a new one. And now we're at the 68th anniversary without a new Geneva Convention. We do have the two protocols from 1977. If you also want to perhaps just mention the importance of the protocols and what they've added to IHL. And how do you think that the conventions are still relevant today? Like, what are their main strengths that they continue to bring to armed conflict?
So yes, the protocols are really important in that they sort of, to answer that question first, they brought what we used to call sort of the Hague Law and the Geneva Law. The Hague Law was about conduct of hostilities, and Geneva Law was really about the protection of persons. And the additional protocols brought sort of the Hague principles, the conduct of hostilities principles, into the Geneva Conventions. So that would sort of be all part of one set body of law. And so that, and it really put forth a lot of things that had developed over time, but just were not written down in the Geneva Conventions, but were already considered customary law in a lot of cases, such as distinguishing between civilians when you're targeting. So it wasn't necessarily revolutionary. There were certainly some aspects that states didn't agree on, but the basic principles about protection of civilians was, I think, pretty well established by the time we get to the protocols. I think, I mean, again, going back even to the 1864, the basic principle of humanitarian law is that it's reflected in what we call the Martin's Clause, which basically says that these rules should reflect basic principles of humanity and the dictates of the public conscience. So the rules you find in IHL, in the laws of armed conflict, should be things that everyone can follow without any difficulty whatsoever. It's mostly negative obligations, so you know, prohibitions, don't do this, don't do that, rather than what you see in human rights law, which are more positive obligations where you're required to do something. And since they're negative obligations, they should be, again, I would say easy to follow. They should be very, very obvious what the rules are, not to torture, not to kill civilians. So I think that is why they're relevant today, because they still represent the very basic principles of humanity. They're not some complicated philosophical rules. They're how we should treat our fellow human beings in very difficult times. And so I think that's why they still resonate today. But there are certainly rules that have changed. I found one of my favorite articles is Article 89 of Geneva Convention 3 on prisoners of war, which requires states to give prisoners of war cigarettes. And I always thought that was really funny. And I was actually looking today at the commentaries preparing for this. And what I didn't know, what Jean Pictet, who wrote the commentaries to the 1949 conventions, I'm quoting here from his commentaries, I thought it was great, talking about tobacco. It calms the nerves of the smokers and helps them to bear their suffering, while it provides non-smokers with a valuable form of currency, which enables them to procure other advantages in exchange. Tobacco is not harmful in the way that alcohol is, and the convention in placing it among things like water, which are essential for the internees, recognizes the important part played by this harmless narcotic in soothing men's minds and nerves. So obviously today we have a very different understanding. I don't think anyone would think that this is the law now, that you must give tobacco because it's not harmful. So there's certainly outdated aspects, but again, I think it's more those basic principles of respecting your fellow human being and treating people humanely that continue to resonate and that haven't changed over time.
I have a question for both of you from like a legal point of view and with your backgrounds. I think about this a lot whenever there's discussions around the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. These people wrote this body of law in a time that they couldn't possibly imagine what the future would look like, and the warfare has evolved in such a different way, and it's evolving rapidly. Do you think that the Geneva Conventions as they stand now covers that? The basic principles cover the issues that we have with urban context, or the fact that, you know, people aren't fighting face to face. Do you think that those basic principles cover that? Do they need to be added to or changed? Or how do you respond whenever people say we need an additional Geneva Convention for that?
I mean, I think there's a couple of answers to that question. I mean, I think overall the rules can still be applied today. They're flexible enough, and again, they're the basic protections we need of our life and of our liberty don't really change over time, no matter what a conflict looks like. I think where we run into issues, or perhaps when you get into very like technical legal questions that can be debated, that are, you know, not about torture, not about killing civilians, but really like how you use a cyber weapon against an enemy, against an opponent.
What is a cyber weapon?
Exactly. I think there you start to run into some conceptual barriers where the rules just are not clear in that they don't provide a clear answer for some of the questions that we ask ourselves now as lawyers and as practitioners. But again, the basic principles, I think, are still relevant and still can be applied regardless of the type of conflict we see. I think it's just going to be on the more technical aspects. What I see as perhaps being a bigger problem is that we note that compliance is perhaps our bigger problem. So it's not that the rules aren't there to protect people. It's that parties to a conflict are not respecting the rules that exist. And how do you persuade, whether it's states or non-state actors, to follow those rules? There's not necessarily an enforcement mechanism. There might be domestic enforcement mechanisms, but at an international level, we have, you know, the International Criminal Court, but that's only if the jurisdiction applies. And I think it's just very difficult to actually pursue accountability. And I think that's perhaps the bigger issue of our time.
How do you work on that? How does ICRC work on that? How does the legal community writ large work on improving compliance? Because, I mean, the numbers that you were saying about the number of civilians that were killed in, World War I and World War II, I mean, that's staggering differences of numbers. How do you get compliance to be...
sorry, not laughing.
Can you solve the world's problems?
Yes, right? Exactly. Of course, right here. I think that there's not going to be one easy solution. I mean, there's a number of different pursuits going on right now that are trying to look at ways to do this. There's ideas to sort of, I'll say, bring back, because it never went away, but to really put some teeth in a fact-finding commission, as foreseen by Additional Protocol 1, where states, even in non-international conflicts, perhaps, even though that's not how it was foreseen when the protocol was written, but could agree to have an independent fact-finding body come and then give recommendations, confidential recommendations to states. You have the idea that maybe there should be a court that is specific to IHL violations. Beyond the International Criminal Court, but again, these are all things that need a political buy-in that we just don't see at the moment. So I think the focus, or the most effective focus right now, is more at a state by state level. So working with individual states on their particular issues, and lots of different groups do this. I can speak on from the ICRC's perspective. We have a number of different ways, but the advisory services, as we call them, going in and helping states to draft legislation to help them implement international law, to work with their courts on trainings, to work with other bodies, such as if they have forensic bodies within their government that need support or capacity building when it comes to looking at missing or disappeared. I mean, there's a lot of different capacity building mechanisms you can use. I think these are ways that you can do it, but again, that's a very sort of slow, step by step, state by state, arm group by arm group. It definitely doesn't solve the world's problems, but hopefully helps improve at least in a gradual way how conflicts are fought.
And I think lawyers don't like to admit this, but it's not always the law, right? I think a lot of the solution could come from looking at sociological, cultural, psychological issues. Why do people choose or not choose to follow IHL? And the ICRC had done this, as you know, the study, People in War, looking, and one of the aspects of it was looking at, who do people look to? Who are their leaders? Are they religious leaders, community leaders, military commanders, right? Sort of in different parts of the world, what do those structures look like? And the ICRC had also previously done a study called The Roots of Behavior in War that we're now updating. And we have a team of people working on that, looking as well at, why do professional militaries follow the law of war? Why do non-state armed groups do it or don't? And sort of what structures exist internally for accountability and responsibility as well. And I think also on your previous question, Nikki, which I think is exactly a question that so many people are asking now, are the conventions, how are they relevant? And the law is always reactive. Right, the law is a slow process, and if we look back at the different conventions, the Geneva Conventions that I had mentioned, most of them were coming out of some significant historical event. And the same with a lot of the weapons conventions as well. When you look at the conventions against landmines and cluster munitions, those were coming out of world events where they were used extensively. And so we had the first Geneva Convention coming out of what Henri Dunant had seen at Solferino. We had another one coming out of, or two coming out of World War One, another four coming out of World War Two. So there has to be that major events, unfortunately, that are happening, and then they have to have that support from states to actually galvanize a desire to sit down for many years and hammer out specific provisions that I think now would be very controversial as well. Well, thank you so much, Andrea.
That was a very interesting conversation.
Thanks for all of the tidbits on the cigarettes.
I love quoting Pictet.
I love that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
There is much more to the places and context in which the ICRC works than just conflict. Despite the hardships, culture, art, and music can still remain, thrive even, in difficult times. It is this human element that is often missing in portrayals of a place at war. So in this segment of the podcast, we bring that element to you, the universal experience of being human, spoken through the language of music. Today, Somalian musician and songwriter Kanan, who came to international success when his song, Waving Flag, was selected as the anthem for the 2010 FIFA World Cup. Here's Kanan with that song. Enjoy.
Take the field now, unify us, make us feel
rejoice in the beautiful game. And together at the end of the day, we all say, when I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. And then it goes back, and then it goes back.
If you enjoyed this episode of Intercross the Podcast, make sure to subscribe for updates at our blog, intercrossblog.icrc.org, and rate and review us on iTunes and SoundCloud. See you next time.